right. It is Friday, 5 p.m., time for American Hit Radio, the Friday edition. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales-Ryan, on the other side of the glass here in the studio.
Somewhere.
There you
are.
In
the universe.
Sort of see you. That's all right. And this is what we do on Fridays. The Friday series is what we call How Music Changed. And to be totally cool, I should make a deal with God, like Kate Bush said. I really need to get about another 40 or 50 years of living in so I can finish this How Music Changed series that I began like 20 years ago. Because we're talking about 250 topics, and I think so far we might have done about 20% of them. So I got a long way to go. But we're going to do our best. And I mention that because today is the start of a brand new series. We spent a long time covering Pink Floyd. And now we go back into the Wayback Machine, which takes us back at this point to about the early 30s. And then we'll work our way up for this one particular artist. And we'll be talking about her for quite a while, I'm afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm looking forward to it, of course. I'm only afraid because it's intimidating. We're going to discuss the life and music of Billie Holiday. And today is part one. Now, the generation that lived in a time when Billie Holiday was a real live jazz artist is long gone into the mists of the inevitable. But the spirit that lives inside of her music lingers almost like a mythical dream. Her status as a performer has taken on legendary proportions that outweighs just about any other musical artist of her time. But it also distracts us from the reality of who she was. Lady Day was larger than life, but that is mostly because she lived every aspect of what life could offer her from the bottom to the top, or vice versa. With this series, the purpose is to play a good number of her vast array of classic recordings, but also to humanize her and to feel the intensity that is an intrinsic part of her songs, to help you understand the power of them, regardless of whether they were beautiful, playful, or forlorn. For that reason, I feel that it's necessary to hear her tell her own story as she lived it, to take her away from the mystical place where most contemporary listeners hear her now, and to try to convey the humanity that ultimately created the legend. So we're going to start, and more or less carry throughout this entire series, with Billie discussing her life in her own words. And of course, then there's going to be the music. So I will be reading from a book called Lady Sings the Blues, which is written in Billie Holiday's words with help from William Dufty. And so what we'll do is we'll put a little bit of better music underneath it. I'm going to have to talk for quite a while because there's a lot about Billie's life that I'm going to have to cover before we even get to music. So it will be a bit of a run of just us telling her story before we get to the point where she is actually an artist, because I think you need to know her past to understand where she eventually comes from. So let's do this now. Here we go. Starting with the book, chapter one. And I'm not reading the entire book, by the way. I want you to know I'm taking segments of it and just to try to get as much of the story as I need to. All right. Here's Billie Holiday's words. Mom and Pop were just a couple of kids when they got married. He was 18, she was 16, and I was 3. Mom was working as a maid with a white family. When they found out that she was going to have a baby, they just threw her out. Pop's family just about had a fit, too, when they heard about it. They were real society folks, and they never heard of things like that going on in their part of East Baltimore. But both kids were poor, and when you're poor, you grow up fast. Pop always wanted to blow the trumpet, but he never got the chance. Before he got one to blow, the army grabbed him and shipped him overseas. It was just his luck to be one of the ones to get it from poison gas over there. It ruined his lungs. I suppose if he played piano, he'd probably have got his shot in the hand. Getting gassed was the end of his hopes for the trumpet, but the beginning of a successful career on the guitar. He started to learn it when he was in Paris, and it was a good thing he did, because it kept him from going to pieces when he got back to Baltimore. He just had to be a musician. He worked like hell when he got back, and eventually got a job with McKinney's Cotton Pickers. But when he went on the road with that band, it was the beginning of the end of our life as a family. Baltimore got to be just another one-night stand. I was a woman when I was 16. I was big for my age, with big breasts, big bones, a big, fat, healthy broad, that's all. So I started working out then, before school and after, minding babies, running errands, and scrubbing those damn white steps all over Baltimore. When families in the neighborhood used to pay me a nickel for scrubbing them down, I decided I had to have more money, so I figured out a way. I bought me a brush of my own, a bucket, some rags, some octagon soap, and a big white bar of that stuff I can't ever forget, Bon Ami. The first time I stood on a white doorstep and asked this woman for 15 cents for the job, she liked to have a fit. But I explained to her the higher price came from me bringing my own supplies. She thought I had a damn nerve, I guess. But while she was thinking it over, I said I'd scrub the kitchen or bathroom floor for the same price. That did it. I had the job. Alice Dean used to keep a whorehouse on the corner nearest our place, and I used to run errands for her and the girls. I was very commercial in those days. I'd never go to the store for anybody for less than a nickel or a dime, but I'd run all over for Alice and the girls, and I'd wash basins, put out the Lifebuoy soap and towels. When it came time to pay me, I used to tell her she could keep the money if she'd let me come up in her front parlor and listen to Louis Armstrong and Bessie Smith on her Victrola. I guess I'm not the only one who heard their first good jazz in a whorehouse, but I never tried to make anything of it. If I'd heard Louis and Bessie at a Girl Scout jamboree, I'd have loved it just the same. But a lot of white people first heard jazz in places like Alice Dean's, and they helped label jazz whorehouse music. They forget what it was like in those days. A whorehouse was about the only place where black and white folks could meet in any natural way. They damn well couldn't rub elbows in the churches. And in Baltimore, places like Alice Dean's were the only joints fancy enough to have a Victrola for real enough to pick up on the best records. My name, Eleonora, was too damn long for anyone to say. Besides, I never liked it, especially not after my grandma shortened it and used to scream Nora at me from the back porch. My father had started calling me Bill because I was such a young tomboy. I didn't mind that, but I wanted to be pretty, too, and have a pretty name. So I decided Billy was it, and I made it stick. But after Pop went on the road with McKinney's Cotton Pickers, he just disappeared. Later, he got a job with Fletcher Henderson's band, but he was always on tour. And then one day we heard that he had gotten a divorce and married a West Indian woman named Fanny. A while after Pop had married again, Mom met Phil Goh. He was a Baltimore longshoreman, but he came from a very high-class family. His sisters were all office workers, and besides, they were very light-skinned and thought it was terrible he was taking up with Mom and me because we were a shade or two darker. But he didn't pay any attention to that. He married Mom anyway, and he was a good stepdaddy to me as long as he lived, which was only a little while. I was happy for a little bit, but it couldn't last. One day I came home from school. Mom was at the hairdresser's and there was nobody in the house but Mr. Dick, one of our neighbors. He told me Mother had asked him to wait for me and then take me a few blocks to somebody's house where she would meet us. Without me thinking anything about it, he took me by the hand and I went along. When we got to the house, a woman let us in. I asked for my mother and they said she would be along soon. I think they told me she had called them on the telephone and said she would be late. It got later and later and I began to get sleepy. Mr. Dick saw me dozing and took me into a back bedroom to lie down. I was almost asleep when Mr. Dick crawled up on me and started trying to do what my cousin Henry used to try. I started trying to kick and scream like crazy. When I did, the woman of the house came in and tried to hold my head and arms down on the bed so he could get at me. I gave both of them a hard time, kicking and scratching and screaming. Suddenly, when I was catching my breath, I heard some more hollering and shouting. The next thing I knew, my mother and a policeman broke the door down. I'll never forget that night. Even if you're a whore, you don't want to be raped. A bitch can turn 2,500 tricks a day and she still don't want nobody to rape her. It's the worst thing that can happen to a woman. And here it was happening to me when I was 10. When they got there, instead of treating me and Mom like somebody who called the cops for help, they treated me like I'd killed somebody. They wouldn't let my mother take me home. Mr. Dick was in his 40s, and I was only 10. Maybe the police sergeant took one look at my breasts and limbs and figured my age from that. I don't know. Anyway, I guess they had me figured for having enticed this old goat into the whorehouse or something. For all I know, for sure, is they threw me into a cell. My mother cried and screamed and pleaded, but they just put her out of the jailhouse and turned me over to a fat white matron. When she saw I was still bleeding, she felt sorry for me and gave me a couple of glasses of milk. But nobody else did anything for me except give me filthy, dirty looks and snicker to themselves. After a couple of days in a cell, they dragged me into court. Mr. Dick got sentenced to 5 years, and they sentenced me to a Catholic institution. The next time my mother came to visit me, I told her if she ever wanted to see me again, she better get me out of there. I guess she knew I meant it, and I did. Anyway, she and Grandpop got a lawyer. Some rich white people my mother was working for helped her out, too. According to the judge, I was supposed to stay there until I was dead or 21. But they finally got me out. Going on to chapter 2. I was only 13, but I was a hip kitty. I was traveling light, except for that basket of chicken, but I was traveling. When I got off Pennsylvania Station in New York, I had never seen a place so big. I was wandering around, taking my own sweet time, looking at all the big buildings, taking it all in. I must have been a sight, traipsing around, gawking with this basket of chicken in my little suitcase. Anyway, this social worker spotted me, and she knew damn well I was lost. It was dark by then. The social worker was white, but she was nice as she could be. She asked me where I had come from, what my name was, where I was going, who my mother was, and all that stuff. But I wouldn't tell her anything, not even my name. Nobody was going to stop me from getting to Harlem. It turned out this woman was with the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. She was going to put me in the shelter they had, but it was too late already. The place was closed for the night. This turned out to be a break. She took me in and bought me dinner, and then we went to a beautiful hotel where she got me a fine room with a bed all to myself. This place knocked me out. Years later, I went back there to see the place and found out that it was only a YWCA, but it looked like the Waldorf Astoria then. This woman was so nice, I tried to give her to give me a job. I'll work for you hard, I told her. I'll clean your house, wash your steps, scrub your floors. But then she'd ask me my name, and I still wouldn't tell her. She was wise to me. She'd smile when I refused to tell her my name. She goes, I know you, she'd tell me. You're smart. I thought I was a real hip kitty. In a matter of days, I had my chance to become a strictly $20-a-day call girl, and I took it. The jelky stuff they made a big deal out of wasn't even new then. The only thing new about it, even to me, was the fancy telephone. I had seen these funny-looking telephones in the movies, the ones you answer lying in bed instead of the old-time wall jobs. From the moment I saw them, I knew that was for me. Not just any kind, though. It had to be a white telephone. And that's what I had at Florence's place. I soon had two young white cats to match I could depend on regularly every week, one on Wednesday, one Saturday. Sometimes one of them would make it twice a week. The madam took five out of every $20 for the rent. This still left me more than I could make in a damn month as a maid. And I had someone doing my laundry. It was a small place. Florence only had two other girls, a yellow one named Gladys and a white girl whose name I don't remember. With my regular white customers, it was a cinch. They had wives and kids to go home to. But when they came to see me, it was wham, bang, and they gave me the money and were gone. I made all the loot I needed. But the Negroes would keep you up all the damn night, handing you that stuff about, is it good, baby, and don't you want to be my old lady? Talk about women getting salty when they get scorned. You should have seen Big Blue. What the hell good is she? He hollered at Florence. She's the only colored girl in the house, and she won't take Negroes. Florence was a fine woman, but it would have been worth her life to stick up for me. Blue knew I was a baby, but he had me busted just the same. He and Bub were real tight with the cops. The next morning, I was in the kitchen with the other girls having breakfast when the cops broke in. They had stool pigeon witnesses with them who screamed at me. That's her, they said, pointing at me. That's her. So they hauled me off to jail. Not for anything I did, but for something I wouldn't do. Those were rotten days. Women like Mom, who worked as maids, cleaned office buildings, were picked up on the street on their way home from work and charged with prostitution. If they could pay, they got off. If they couldn't, they went to court, where it was the word of some dirty, grafting cop against theirs. I knew if you pleaded guilty, you caught hell. If you pleaded not guilty, you might even get worse. I didn't even have anybody to get me a lawyer, not that it would have done much good. If that judge had guessed for a minute that I was only 15, she would have probably have packed me off to Bedford Reformatory until I was 21. But Mon came down to court and stopped that. She swore in a stack of Bibles I was 18. If they had checked up on her, it would have shown Mom had given birth to me when she was 9. But they didn't. It cost Mom a lot to tell a lie like that. She couldn't stand lying and made me the same way. She never lied unless she needed to save somebody's life, and neither did I. I might have done all my time at the hospital, but bad luck was dogging me. One night, a big dyke went after me. They call them lesbians now, but we just called them dykes. She tried to get at me. I took a poke at her, and down the stairs she went. So they threw me out of the hospital after 2 weeks, and I found myself back in the old Jefferson Market Court. The same court, same judge, only this time she was really mad. "I thought I was giving you a chance," she spotted at me. "But you turned out to be a girl of bad character." Wham, bang, 4 months she handed me, and I was off to Welfare Island. That place was filthy. 50 girls were packed together in one awful ward, and some of them with TB. We got the kind of garbage to eat you wouldn't feed your dog. Every once in a while, we'd all get put to work cleaning up the joint. That meant a bunch of social workers would come trooping through making an inspection. But after they'd leave, the rats would come out again, and everything would slide back to filthy, dirty normal. But one day, they let me out, and I graduated to the laundry. My last job there was a real break. I got to cook for the warden and his family. I used to make them crazy dishes I had learned from Mom, things she used to make for rich people, like chicken cacciatore with mushrooms and roast duck. This used to knock him out. When my time was running out, he made me an offer to stay on and cook for him. "You come to my house, and I'll cook for you," I told him. "I'm never coming back here." So I went to Jamaica, Long Island. There I met Dorothy Glass. She had a big house out there where she ran poker games and other kinds of gambling. She was a real nice dame, the type of woman Mom thought Florence Williams was. I stayed with her, waiting on tables and helping out to pay my way while I kept out of circulation. Once in a while, I used to go to the Elks Club in Jamaica and sing. This way, I could pick up a little change. But at Dorothy's place, the toughest job I had was keeping her husband Lee out of my hair. By this time, I could see trouble coming, so I quit when it was still ahead. Chapter 3, which is called Painting the Town Red. I had decided I was through turning tricks as a call girl, but I had also decided I wasn't going to be anybody's damn maid. The rent always seemed to be due, and it took some scuffling to keep from breaking my vows. About that time, Fletcher Henderson's band was working downtown at the Roseland Ballroom. It was the first Negro band to work there, and Pops Holiday was with him on the guitar. Sick as she was, Mom was too proud to turn to Pop and ask him to help with the rent money, but not me. I used to go right down there and haunt him. Pop was in his early 30s then, but he didn't want anyone to guess it, especially the young chicks who used to hang around the entrance waiting for the musicians. I was around 15 by then, but I looked plenty old enough to vote. I used to wait for him down in the hallway. I'd try to catch his eye and call out to him, "Hey, Daddy." I soon found out just waving at him would make him feel like 45, and he didn't like that. He used to plead with me. "Please," he'd say, "whatever you do, don't call me Daddy in front of these people." "I'm going to call you Daddy all night unless you give me some damn money for rent," I'd tell him. That would do it. I'd take the money home to Mom, proud as all get out. But I couldn't hurt her feelings by telling her where it came from. If she kept worrying me about it, I'd finally tell her I stole it. Then we'd have a fight, and she'd tell me I was going to end up in jail again. I walked down 7th Avenue from 139th Street to 133rd Street, busting in every joint trying to find a job. In those days, 133rd Street was a real swing street, like 52nd Street later tried to be. It was jumping with after-hour spots, regular-hour joints, restaurants, cafes, a dozen to the block. Finally, when I got to Pods and Jerry's, I was desperate. I went in and asked for the boss. I think I talked to Jerry. I told him I was a dancer and I wanted to try out. I knew exactly two steps, the time step and the crossover. I didn't even know the word audition existed, but that was what I wanted. So Jerry sent me over to the piano player and told me to dance. I started, and it was pitiful. I did my two steps over and over until he barked at me and told me to quit wasting his time. They were going to throw me out of my ear, but I kept begging for the job. Finally, the piano player took pity on me. He squashed out his cigarette, looked up at me, and said, "Girl, can you sing?" I said, "Sure I can sing. What good is that?" I'd been singing all my life, but I enjoyed it too much to think I could make any real money at it. Besides, those were the days of the Cotton Club and all those glamour pusses who didn't do anything but look pretty, shake a little, and take money off tables. I thought that was the only way to make money, and I needed 45 bucks by morning to keep Mom from getting set out in the street. Singers were never heard of then, unless it was Paul Robeson, Julian Bledsoe, or someone legit like that. So I asked him to play Travelin' All Alone. That came closer than anything to the way I felt. And some part of it must have come across. The whole joint quieted down. If someone had dropped a pin, it would have sounded like a bomb. When I finished, everybody in the joint was crying in their beer. And I picked 38 bucks up off the floor. When I left the joint that night, I split with the piano player and still took home $57. I went out and bought a whole chicken and some baked beans. Mom loved baked beans. And raced up 7th Avenue to the house. When I showed Mom the money for the rent and told her I had a regular job singing for $18 a week, she could hardly believe it. Every night, the limousines would wheel uptown. The Minx and Ermines would climb over one another to be the first one through the coal bins or over the garbage pails into the newest spot that was, quote, the place, unquote. Everything there for me started for me there at the log cabin. A lot of big people used to come around. One night, the boss introduced me to Paul Muni, who was standing at the bar. Another time, John Hammond, who was on his way to becoming a big man in the music business, came in. The next night, he brought Mildred Bailey, Red Norvo, and a young, serious, good-looking fellow named Benny Goodman. Mildred was the famous rocking chair lady. Red was a well-known musician and Mildred's husband. And Benny was a radio station musician who talked a lot then about having his own band one day. They used to come around often. One night, Mildred slapped Red Norvo's face and walked out of the place. They told me she was jealous of me and Red. But I didn't even know that he'd noticed me. By then, Bobby Henderson was playing piano for me. I still think he was the greatest. Another time, John Hammond brought in Joe Glazer, the big agent and manager. He was handling Louis Armstrong, Mildred Bailey, and practically everybody who got to be anybody. Glazer signed me up on the spot. Then, I started moving from club to club in Harlem, and everywhere I went, something was happening. Of all the big people who came up to hear me sing, I think I liked Bernie Hannigan the best. He was a famous songwriter. I loved his songs, and I loved him. I used to feature When a Woman Loves a Man and When the Moon Turns Green, both of his tunes. Bernie used to stay in a joint for hours listening to me sing and giving me tips when I did his tunes. But for him, I'd have gladly sung anything for nothing. I loved that guy. Benny came around plenty too, and eventually he asked me to make my first record with him. I'll never forget it. Benny came up to get me and took me to the studio downtown. When we got there and I saw this big old microphone, it scared me half to death. I'd never sung in one, and I was afraid of it. Nobody was wise to how scared I was except for Buck of the famous team Buck and Bubbles, who was around for that session. Buck dug what was the matter with me and tried to snap me out of it. "Don't let all these white folks see you scared," he begged me. "They'll be laughing at you." He finally got me to stand near it, told me I didn't have to look at it or even sing into it, just stand near it. He was getting nowhere until he started to shame me, telling me that I didn't have the nerve to go through with it. That did it. I just ignored the thing, and we did two tunes, Your Mother's Son-in-Law and Riffin' the Scotch. I got 35 bucks for the session, but nothing happened with the record. I got both of those tracks right here, right now, the very first two things that Billie Holiday ever recorded, Your Mother's Son-in-Law, and we'll segue it into Riffin' the Scotch. ¶¶
jumped out of the frying pan right into the fire. When I lost me a cheating man and got a no-count lie. Swipe the old one for the new one. Now the new one's breaking my heart. I jumped out of the frying pan right into the fire. Lord, right into the fire.
So, Marnie, you're listening to WHPC, WHPC HD 90.3 in Garden City, New York. You're listening to the How Music Changed series, and we're doing part one of our coverage of Billie Holiday, and we just got started with the music. Those are the first two songs that we got to, that we're covering in this series. A couple of interesting things about it. That the first song was titled Your Mother's Son-in-Law, which is a mistake, because that doesn't make any sense. And it's the way that Billie sings it that does make sense. She goes, to make you my mother's son-in-law. That's what it should be, is my mother's son-in-law. But they screwed up the title. And the second track was called Riffin' the Scotch. Had that little opening with a little Loch Lomond sort of a thing there. Mostly an instrumental that was really one of the earlier recordings by Benny Goodman and his band. For both of those tracks. The date was November 27, 1933, when Billie Holiday entered the studio and recorded those two songs. The band consisted of Charlie Teagarden, Shirley Clay on trumpet, Jack Teagarden on trombone, Benny Goodman, of course, on clarinet, they have Buck Washington on piano, Artie Bernstein on bass. Gene Krupa is the drummer. And, of course, our hero in this series, Billie Holiday, singing her very first two professional songs. She would never include any of those songs in her nightlife repertoire. She just did not ever perform them live as it is. But there it is, November 1975. Now, if I go back to the book where I left off, the very next paragraph from where I dropped off, she says, later on, John Hammond paired me up with Teddy Wilson and his band for another record session. Well, when she says later on, turns out that that's like over a year and a half later on, because the next recording that Billie Holiday made was on July 2nd of 1935. So you're going from November 33 to July of 35. That's a long time span that Billie's basically just skipping over in her book. But I just figured I'd mention that. She goes, John Hammond paired me up with Teddy Wilson and his band for another record session. This time, I got $30 for making half a dozen sides, including songs like Miss Brown to You and a few others that we're going to cover right here. So let's play at least two of them back to back. First one is a song that we'll play. It's a song called I Wished on the Moon. A song from the composers Ralph Ranger and Dorothy Parker. It was just kind of amazing because it wasn't easy for a singer, a black singer, to get songs to record because the music publishers had power and they wanted to get the money, and they figured that they wanted to have where the audience would be buying it would normally be white people. But Hammond was able to get this one for Billie. John Hammond did an awful lot to help Billie's career. And this is also Teddy Wilson making a short introduction, and he shares the opening with Benny Goodman. And after that, we'll play a track called What a Little Moonlight Can Do. We'll be back after those two.
Little moonlight can do.
Well, there we are. Now, the first two tracks were very, very early recordings of the Benny Goodman and his orchestra. Well, the two tracks we just heard were credited to Teddy Wilson and his orchestra, the handsome and soon immensely famous piano player, Teddy Wilson, who would play with people like Ella Fitzgerald, Lena Horne, you name it. He was just pretty much playing with everybody, like one of the kings of piano jazz at that time, Teddy Wilson. And he and Billie Holiday loved each other. They just were this early in her career. The fact that she teamed up with him was just like kismet, really. They would go on to record almost 100 songs in their careers together, which is really saying something. And the band, listen, this is the band that we just heard on these two tracks, I Wished on the Moon and What a Little Moonlight Can Do. The band has Roy Eldridge on trumpet. That is Benny Goodman on clarinet. Ben Webster on tenor sax. Teddy Wilson on piano, of course. John Trueheart is on guitar. John Kirby is on bass. Cozy Cole is the drummer. And, of course, Billie Holiday taking the vocals. So there's that. Like I said, we just took a jump forward in about 1.5 years for those two songs, taking us into July of 1935. Got a few more from that, not that session, but from like pretty much the same band. But I'll get back to the book a little bit here. Again, Billy's words. I didn't even know what royalties were in those days. I was glad to get the $30. I was billed as the vocalist with Teddy's band, and that was all. But after a year or so, when the record started moving, I figured they were selling as much on the strength of my name getting known as Teddy's, and I tried to get some more loot, but I couldn't. It was then that Bernie Hannigan really went to bat for me. He had a job as a musical director at Columbia. They also put up records on the Vocalion label at 35 cents. Bernie pitched such a bitch up there at the office, he finally made them pay me $75 for two sides. In those days, you could take it or leave it. It didn't make any difference if the record companies made thousands off the records later. You'd never get another dime. This $75 sometimes included tunes of my own that I had written. I got no royalties for them either. Bernie almost lost his job at Columbia fighting for me. A lot of guys were big tippers uptown, but when it came to fighting for you downtown, they were nowhere. Not Bernie. He was the cause of me making my first records under my own name, not as anybody's damn vocalist, but as Billie Holiday, period. And then the list of musicians backing me. Bernie Hannigan is a great guy. Well, this is just before. That's still being credited to Teddy Wilson and his orchestra. The session this time is from July 31st of 1935. And we'll start with... Where are we now? Miss Brown to You is the track I want to play. And we'll let that segue into A Sunbonnet Blue. I have to stop it because I have to tell you something about this song. It's really, really crazy. Like, nutty, funny, important. Somebody was listening to the song, Miss Brown to You, really closely. And if you listen, at the 32-second point, you can literally hear a car horn beeping in the background. When they were recording this in the studio, they didn't have, the stuff to, kill sound. So they were close enough to the street, maybe with a window right there, and a guy beeped his horn. And you can hear it on the track at just about the 32-second mark. So listen real close. I think it's really cool to be able to hear that car horn beeping on Miss Brown to You at 32 seconds. Anyway, sorry for stopping it. Had to tell you that. Thank you.
Just wait and you'll see the love of a little Miss Brownie is baby to me. Yes, yes. Lock it down.
You can only imagine how Billie Holiday is feeling about this at this point in time. She doesn't really say it outright, but how immensely proud she must have been to be singing with some of the best musical talent in the world at this point in time, backing her up. I mean, with Ted Wilson being the pianist and bringing her in to be the vocalist. And you have Ben Webster. I mean, the song that I just played, Sunbonnet Blue, might not be like a remarkably famous song that, you know, people would necessarily care to hear. But it has Ben Webster playing that opening tenor sax part, which is beautiful. And Billie Holiday singing it. So this is like history. And you can hear that Billy, in a way, gives like a tip of her hat to the musicians while she's singing. Even when she, like, when Teddy Wilson goes to take, like, his little soul, she'll go like, yeah, yeah. It's just nice. Like, she's feeling it. And that's, like, so awesome. Anyway, back to her book a little bit. People started coming back to hear me. Franchotone and his lovely mother used to come to every place I ever worked, from Pods and Jerry's to Dickie Wells. Mrs. Tone was crazy about me, and she loved Billy Haywood and Cliff Allen, who had a great act at the Basement Brownies. At the Hacha, I met Ralph Cooper. He was a big shot who'd been in the movies already, and he used to tell Frank Schiffman, who ran the Lafayette Theater and the Apollo, who to hire. Ralph convinced Schiffman to come and catch me. When Schiffman asked Cooper what style I had, Cooper was stumped. You never heard singing so slow, so lazy, with such a drawl, he told him. But he couldn't put any label on me. This, I always figured, was the biggest compliment they could pay me. Before anybody could compare me with other singers, they were comparing other singers with me. It ain't the blues, was all Cooper could tell him. I don't know what it is, but you got to hear her. So Schiffman came up. After he heard me, he offered to put me on the bill at the Apollo for $50 a week. This was something in those days. Uptown, the Apollo was what the Palace was downtown. We'll leave you here. And if we're lucky, we'll squeeze in two tracks. We're going to start with I'm Painting the Town Red, and we'll end with It's Too Hot for Words. Listen to Ben Webster on his sax on that last track if we get it in. It's amazing.
private conversation. Don't let's talk or even walk, but if you want to make love, okay. It's too hot for words, there's nothing like relaxation. Can't endure this temperature, but if you want to make love, okay. Let's find a cozy nook beside a babbling brook. Let's find a shaded tree, let the lovebirds talk for you and me. Cause it's much too hot for words, why bother with conversation? Goodness knows my eyes is closed all the day.